This is Charlotte Talks. I'm Mike Collins. It's no secret that newspapers are struggling in the digital world, in a milieu where people get their news in short snippets, tweets of 140 characters, and quick notifications on their smartphones. Newspapers are discovering that one thing that keeps them relevant is something they do best, long-form investigative journalism. Recently, the Charlotte Observer and other papers in the McClatchy chain published a series on the construction industry. They titled it Contract to Cheat, and it outlined the systematic mistreatment and misclassification of workers, abuse of the tax code, and a disinterested government. The series revealed billions of dollars of cost to taxpayers and millions of workers' lives impacted, all in the name of the bottom line. It's an important piece of work that got congressional attention in short order, but may have eluded yours if you're not a subscriber. So we've invited two of the reporters who worked on this series to join us. Rick Rothacker is a longtime award-winning business reporter at the Charlotte Observer. Welcome back.
Thanks, Mike.
And also rejoining us by phone is Mandy Locke, staff writer for the Raleigh News and Observer. Her 2012 series, The Ghost Workers, led to this current series and won her a Gerald Loeb Award for Business Reporting. Thank you for rejoining us, Mandy. Nice to talk to you again.
Absolutely.
Since this story grew out of your original story several years ago, Mandy, in Raleigh, and your series, The Ghostwriters, let me ask you where the idea for that original story came from and why McClatchy newspapers felt that it could be expanded upon or should be expanded upon.
So I started looking into practices in the construction industry in 2012, after I started writing about problems involving workers' comp insurance and companies just sort of ignoring their responsibility to provide that for their employees. And I started hearing from a lot of construction companies who informed me about this practice, treating workers as independent contractors rather than employees in order to save in labor costs. And what I was able to do in 2012 was explain the practice and its impact anecdotally. There was a lot of conversation among state leaders at the time about need for reform, but what I recurringly heard was a lack of sense of how much this was actually happening. And so that's what we started to do with this project in early 2013 by collecting payroll forms on federally funded projects that showed us just how much this practice was happening in the state of North Carolina and beyond.
You know, it might be one thing for a single newspaper to do a story like this, but this was not a single newspaper. This was several newspapers in the McClatchy chain, the News and Observer in Raleigh, the Charlotte Observer here, the Miami Herald, the Fort Worth Star-Telegram, the McClatchy Washington Bureau. Were there other papers involved as well?
We had the Miami Herald paper in Fort Worth.
Right.
We actually got ProPublica involved, which is a nonprofit journalism organization. Basically, Mandy kind of formed a coalition of the willing to help go through these documents, and she sort of laid out a roadmap that papers around the country were able to kind of dive in and find their own projects.
How do you coordinate the efforts of all these papers and all these newsrooms in all these different locations? I mean, is there an editor-in-chief for the story? Is there somebody who assigns reporters to do certain things? Do reporters enterprise their own pieces in this, and then somebody decides what part of that piece will be incorporated? How does it work?
Well, I'd say that sort of accidentally on purpose. I wish we could claim that every bit of this was smooth and that we knew the scope and the process from day one, but it developed over time. And Rick is being funny, but it really did take a band of the willing, and we had a number of editors who jumped to the front of the project. My editor here in Raleigh, Steve Riley, tried to wrangle all of the various pieces and parts and people from across the newspaper company. But it's funny, there are colleagues that worked very intensely on this project from day one, whom I've never met. We've just spoken over the phone. So this was a project that McClatchy had never endeavored before, and somehow, some way, I think we pulled it off.
Hmm. But is it easy to do this? It must be very difficult to do this. And it also seems to be a tremendous commitment for papers who are struggling, in some cases, to keep the lights on. Not necessarily here. I think the paper's still pretty strong here. But, I mean, it's tough. It's a tough time. And when you embark on something like this, you don't know what the outcome is going to be.
Yeah, I mean, that's the challenge is that, you know, myself, you're working on some other stories. Patrick Cannon's story kind of came up in the middle of all this, so we had distractions. Other papers probably have even less staffing than The Observer or The News and Observer, so they had to, you know, decide to put somebody on it and have them keep at it. Reporters in Fort Worth and Miami in particular, they really – it was impressive because it was a lot of work that Mandy had already started in North Carolina, but in the other states they had to kind of start from scratch and navigate the bureaucracy and figure out how to get these records.
Did you, obviously you knew that there was something there was a pattern of behavior that you established in your story 2 years ago, Mandy, but was it easy to extrapolate and say, well, if it's happening here, it's probably happening in Miami. It's probably happening in Fort Worth. The government's not is looking the other way, so the Washington Bureau will probably find that this is happening all over the country. Is that where the thinking went?
It was, Mike, and it was kind of a risky supposition, right? Because we had invested so many resources. We had lawsuits to get these records. They were all in hard copy. So imagine bankers' boxes full of records arriving bit by bit over weeks and over months. And so to get to that moment where we say, you know what, we think that this problem is extending far beyond North Carolina, so much so that we're going to tap other newspapers within our company to go on this hide-and-seek for these records. It was a pretty bold gesture by McClatchy, and I think that your point earlier on, Mike, about this is what newspapers do best is right on point.
Well, let's talk about a little more about extrapolating out, because you looked at payroll reports from companies working on federally funded projects, and you found that many of these companies had misclassified workers as contractors. We'll talk about the difference in a second, but as contractors, and as a result, they didn't withhold taxes. These were just companies working on federally funded projects. So can we extrapolate out to say that there are companies that do this in the private sector, not federally funded projects?
Absolutely, and here's why. In the years that we evaluated, bear in mind that we were deep in a recession and a slumbering recovery. And so many of the companies that sought refuge in these federally funded projects, many of them were stimulus projects, had been working in the private sector doing residential work or privately funded multifamily work for years. And they show up on these projects, and so we have this window into the industry for a period of time in which a more diverse population of construction firms are doing business on these projects. We saw payroll records just in the state of North Carolina for nearly 900 companies. And these payroll reports showed us exactly how these companies were considering their workers, employees versus independent contractors. Now, a lot of economists and statisticians will tell you that the numbers that we saw on these projects were probably conservative because the mere requirement to turn in your payroll records to tell the government what you're doing when your employment practices may be running afoul of labor laws and IRS codes should have been a deterrent. So these numbers may, in fact, be quite conservative.
What kind of federally funded projects are we talking about here? Are they bridges and roads? Are they apartment buildings? What are they?
Yeah, these are affordable housing projects. So, you know, the one in Concord that I visited and did some work on, you know, they described it as just workforce housing. You know, it's nothing fancy, but this is not you know, low end. It's nice. There's, you know, gazebos and, you know, nicely taken care of grounds. And the idea is, at least the one in Concord that I looked at, it's designed for people who are making a certain percentage of the median income, and they're able to get in at a good rate. And so the government helps subsidize these through a tax break tax system.
And the company that got the contract for that, what were they doing prior to that, prior to the federally funded project coming their way?
You know, a lot of these there's companies that are specializing in these apartment projects. They may do all kinds of different projects, but that we did find there's some that sort of they get into this groove of they've got a general contractor, they follow them from place to place around the state or even the southeast building these projects.
You may not be able to answer this question, neither of you may, but if the payroll records that you collected from these projects indicate that they were misclassifying their employees as contractors when they in fact were employees and should have had W-2 forms and not 1099s, can you say that they just did it for these federally funded projects because they wanted to expedite the hiring and the building of these projects to get the money coming in, or that they have always operated like this on other projects?
You can't say for sure. The guess would be they might be doing it on other projects. Like Mandy said, this was sort of a specific period where there was not a lot of work going on. And I know when I talked to contractors, they would say this was about the only thing going on during this time period in the recession. So they were trying very hard to get in the best bids to get their projects and get work, whether they were the general or the subcontractor. And Mandy may be able to speak more better to that.
Mandy?
We do know, Mike, from talking to a number of these subcontractors that we believe were misclassifying their workers, that they have been doing it for years and years and years. Some of them, their practices had evolved over time as the construction industry struggled, and they eventually found they could not compete unless they offloaded employees from their payroll and treated them as independent contractors. But we don't have any evidence that this was suddenly a new practice because it was a federally funded project. In fact, we have evidence to the contrary.
So this boils down to employee classification. And for a lot of people, they don't understand what this means. I don't think I understood it completely till I read your story. But what's the difference between a contractor? You hire somebody to be a contractor, a subcontractor, or you hire somebody to be your employee. What is the difference? Mandy.
So think about it this way, Mike. Your shower breaks and you have to call in a plumber. This plumber is going to tell you when he's available. He's going to tell you the rate he charges. He's going to bring his own tools and equipment and the expertise to be able to fix your plumbing. That guy is an independent contractor. You have no control over his comings or goings or the prices that he sets.
Or how he's going to do his work, right?
Exactly. But say that you have a massive plumbing problem and you call a plumbing company and they bring a supervisor and four guys with them, and that crew has to work diligently for days. The guy in charge is telling the underlings where to go, what to do, how to do it. Those workers should be employees. They are being directed and controlled and compensated by standards for the company by that company.
So in the construction business, in the building business, if I'm a company that builds apartment complexes, for instance, what would the normal course of action be? Would I have a plumbing division and a framing division and a heating and cooling division that comes in at the appropriate, and an electrical division that comes in at the appropriate time to do the work needed, and they would be my employees? They work for XYZ company. Or would I go out and hire the AB company to work for my company? We'll have to take a break. We'll come back, get an answer to that, and talk about the differences involved in those two things and what's actually going on. We're talking to Rick Rothafker from the Charlotte Observer and Mandy Locke from the Raleigh News and Observer, and we're coming right back. Charlotte Talks on WFAE. Support for Charlotte Talks comes from WFAE members and the law firm Pointer Spruill, celebrating 25 years of serving business clients in Charlotte with other offices in Raleigh, Rocky Mount, Southern Pines, and Wilmington. Information available at pointerspruill.com. We live in a digital world, but the Farmer's Almanac survives. In fact, it thrives. For over 200 years, it's predicted long-range forecasts, shared recipes, homespun wisdom while providing farming insights. And we're going to speak to the 13th editor of the Farmer's Almanac in 200 years, also the first female editor of the Almanac tomorrow at 9, and then observe something else that happened 200 years ago, more than 200 years ago, the Battle of Charlotte. That's tomorrow at 9.
On the next Diane Rehm Show, scientists report global greenhouse gas emissions spiked to record levels in 2013. The state of climate change and growing pressure on world leaders to take action.
Join the Diane Rehm Show this morning from 10 to noon after Charlotte Talks on listener-funded 90.7 WFAE, Charlotte's NPR news source.
It's Charlotte Talks on listener-funded 90.7 WFAE and 90.3 WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. We're talking about Contract to Cheat. That's a recent series of articles that appeared in not only the pages of the Charlotte Observer, but in many McClatchy papers across the country, including the Miami Herald and the Fort Worth Telegraph or whatever it's called down there, and the Raleigh News and Observer. And Rick Rothacker from the Charlotte Observer, it was one of the reporters. Mandy Locke was another, and I've actually kind of stemmed from her original series 2 years ago in the Raleigh News and Observer. Let me get back to how this works. I have the Mike Collins Apartment Construction Company. I could have an electrical division, a plumbing division, a roofing division, a framing division, and they would all be my employees on whom I'm paying taxes and paying benefits. Or I could go out and hire the Rick Rothacker Plumbing Company and the Mandy Locke Electrical Company to do the work. Is that what's happening here? Is that what we're talking about? Or are we talking about the Mike Collins Construction Company hiring Rick Rothacker and saying he's the Rick Rothacker Electric Company?
Largely what happens is the general contractor, which is the big construction company, they have very few employees. They've got a couple of superintendents. They've got a CEO. They have some bookkeepers. You know, they have, you know, HR. They know how to run the company. And those people are actually employees, but that may be 10, 12 people. And then all the other work, the people swinging hammers and using wrenches and driving nails, those are subcontractors. So you have a framing guy, a plumbing guy.
Let's be clear. There's nothing illegal about that.
That's fine. We got into these individual subcontractors, the plumbers, right, the framers. It's the people below them, their crew. Just like Mandy explained, those folks, more often than not, should be an employee because they're being told what to do and where to go.
So it's not my company. It's your company that's employing these, what you call a tactic of misclassifying these employees. Was it happening because of legal loopholes in the law, a misinterpretation of the law, because it's easier for small construction companies to not have to keep track of all this and do all the paperwork necessary to keep up with it? So they say, hey, you're just going to be a contractor. Or is it a deliberate flaunting of the law? Mandy.
You know, Mike, it's quite clear to see why this is happening. I mean, the temptation is so obvious. A company can save a lot of money. A company that treats their workers as independent contractors saves 20% or more in labor costs. So that's a really obvious temptation. Now, why it's happening and why it has persisted the way that it has in the state of North Carolina, you can point to a number of factors. We haven't had a particularly aggressive regulatory oversight effort into these problems. It's happened so much that people have accepted this as standard operating procedure. And we have a really large supply of undocumented workers who are willing to accept these sort of employment arrangements without asking questions or lodging complaints. So in North Carolina, we sort of had a perfect storm of events that led to this problem. But whether companies were doing it intentionally or whether they were doing it because they didn't know any better, at the end of the day, it doesn't quite matter because as a business owner, it's your obligation to know the labor laws, to know the tax code, and to consult professionals if you don't know what you're doing.
Well, let me ask you this. If I own the plumbing company that's been hired by the construction company, so I become a subcontractor and I hire plumbers to do the work that my company has been contracted to do, I have a choice. I can hire the plumbers as employees, make them fill out W-2s, pay the income taxes, deduct their income taxes from their paycheck, and send in Social Security payments, etc. Or I can hire them as subcontractors, in which case I would give them a 1099, and they would handle their own tax reporting and Social Security payments, et cetera. That's where the 20% savings comes in that you talked about, Mandy, that the company doesn't pay the Social Security, their portion of the Social Security. The employee pays their – or the contractor pays it. That's not illegal. That's perfectly legal. So where – who – if the taxes aren't being paid and the Social Security isn't being paid, is that on me as the contractor or is that on the person hammering the nails and doing the plumbing job who I consider to be a contractor?
I'd say the first step to that problem, to that latter example is there may be a way you can do it, but there, like Mandy said, there's a lot of rules around that. You'd have to say these people can come and go whenever they want. I've told the general contractor I'm going to get this plumbing work done by the end of the month, but these people can come whenever they feel like, do whatever other jobs they want. It's not very practical for that to actually happen. But there is some responsibility if there isn't a legitimate 1099 situation for people to actually pay their taxes. And the IRS has shown that not often, you know, people aren't always paying as much as they owe. And Mandy can probably speak more to this as well.
That's right. The IRS estimates that self-employed people who are compensated with 1099 or cash payments underreport their income by 56%. So that's where the tax gap, that's where those tax losses that we calculated are coming from primarily. Now, we believe from interviews with workers who were on these projects across the state that as many as half of these workers may have been completely off the books, no 1099 issued, paid in cash or check, and those workers have even less tax compliance.
So this is where the rubber meets the road. This is why readers should care. In your introduction to the series, you write, it's a tactic that costs taxpayers, that's us, billions of dollars each year. Yet when it comes to public projects, government regulators have done nearly nothing about it, even when the proof is easy to get. The workers don't have protections. The companies don't withhold taxes. The regulators don't seem to care. Is this a conspiracy, or is it a perfect storm of perpetrators, victims, and lazy bureaucracy? Mandy?
That's a really good question, Mike. I didn't find any evidence that construction firms and regulators were meeting in dark alleys to plot out this system that persisted on these projects. I think instead what happened is this practice just persisted so long and so few people really codified in clear language that regulators at all the levels, federal, state, and local, could identify, spot these problems, and address them in short order. And imagine for a moment, these payroll forms are coming in with clear and obvious signs that these workers, these hourly workers, these $8 an hour cleaning crews, these $10 an hour carpenters were treated as independent contractors rather than employees. But no one in the federal government had trained the local housing authority people to spot, identify, and try to prevent this type of practice. It was some major oversight, and it extended in the stimulus projects as well, even when there were so many more layers of oversight and regulation for these type of projects.
One thing we found is, you know, these payroll forms that we gathered were housed at the local housing authorities, and they're the ones who they're literally going through line by line looking at these, and they're looking for some things or making sure a brick mason is categorized as a brick mason instead of a laborer, and then right there in front of them on that exact same form, it's showing no taxes being withheld. And when we would talk to them at places all over the state, they would just say that wasn't something I was looking for. That's not my job. That's not an IRS thing.
Yeah, not my part department. Well, why is it that why is the IRS blind to this then? They're blind to a lot of things. There was a report on 60 Minutes this past Sunday. It's alarming what they don't know. It's amazing what you can get away with. Who knew? Mandy, why doesn't the IRS know? Why doesn't the North Carolina Department of Revenue know?
So when we collected these records, I think one of the startling factors here is that when we looked and inspected these hard copy records, we were maybe like the fourth or fifth people to ever inspect these records. Regulators from the IRS, from the Department of Labor, are not systematically going out, collecting, and checking these records. I spent some time in Washington this year, and what I quickly realized, and regulators and officials there were quick to admit it, that our agencies have this stovepipe mentality. They tend to a very specific, rigid set of rules, and then another agency across town tends to another set of rules, but there's no one entity looking at this bigger picture or coordinating a way to share information to really crack down on this in a comprehensive way.
Hmm. Your series involved reporting, as we've said, from 8 newsrooms in 7 states over the course of a year. But the first sentence of the first story in the paper read, North Carolina has become a breeding ground for construction companies willing to break rules at the expense of honest business owners, vulnerable workers, and unsuspecting taxpayers. Had we read this report in the Miami Herald or in the Fort Worth Star-Telegram, would they have replaced Florida or Texas in that first sentence?
The way this series kind of worked out is individual newsrooms did their own stories looking at their own states, and then there were national stories that Mandy was a key person on, and then Franco Ordonez and our McClatchy Bureau, they were writing stories that everyone could share. So there's sort of almost like two parallel stories. And Texas, they found, I think, $1.2 billion in tax losses compared to the $470 million here in North Carolina. So everyone kind of tailored it to their own audience.
So if it is true that North Carolina is this breeding ground for construction companies breaking rules, why? Is there something about North Carolina that makes this a particularly good place to cheat? Mandy?
Yeah, as I was starting to explain earlier, Mike, we have a number of factors that led to what we're seeing here. For starters, we haven't had regulators really being aggressive or any one agency tackling this in a comprehensive way. We have undocumented workers that are willing to endure these types of employment, these types of casual employment arrangements. We have an absolute lack of unions, which in other states like Illinois and New York, where there was a union person, there would be someone from a union actually inspecting these records in addition to the government who could flag problems if they arose. So these factors, as well as low wages for construction workers, have sort of made North Carolina not just a place where this persists, but a place where companies from other states are willing to come in because the risk of being stopped from misclassifying workers is so very low.
And in fact, your series points out that although this is happening across the country, it is particularly acute in high-growth southern states, and for the same reasons, the migrant workers that come here, the undocumented workers that make themselves available, and the lack of unions. Why is this? I would think that a lot of these undocumented workers don't really know much about what their responsibilities to the tax system are, but you report in your story that some of them are alarmed that they're not paying taxes. They know they're not. They don't know how to do it. And it's not being withheld, and they feel that they should, but they don't want to turn themselves in because if they do, then they're going to be deported, or they think they're going to be deported. Talk about that.
I think that's a big dilemma for those workers. Franco went to California and did some stories and probably some of the more powerful pieces in the paper. And there was workers who even – they would get paid in cash, but they'd have to give some of their money back to their boss. So they were really in a sticky situation where they had to kind of go along with it and were sort of being abused on top of what was happening with the companies.
This is modern servitude, essentially.
It can feel like that.
State government officials obviously knew about this problem before you reported on it even the first time, because there was a bill in the legislature in 2011, a year before you reported your first story, Mandy, aimed at criminalizing willful misclassification and providing protections to workers who report bosses that treat them as independent contractors when in fact they are employees. It never left committee. That bill never left committee. Is that because we are a pro-business state? What's going on there?
I think there are a number of factors at play here. We don't have a lot of legislators who sort of brand themselves as worker rights, worker advocate types down at the General Assembly. There are a lot of business interests that that tend to take hold in the General Assembly. And there's also a lot of politics at play here. The representative who sponsored the bill in 2012, his party was no longer in any sort of position to be pushing forward legislation. The Republicans took over both chambers of the General Assembly, and so his political clout, his political power diminished in those coming years. But I think that there is a resurgence of interest. I have been told by both legislators and executive branch officials, as well as the governor himself, that they will commit themselves to pushing forward legislation to more aggressively combat these problems and potentially criminalize the activity and go after these business people who are doing it.
Well, in the aftermath of your first story in 2012, Governor Perdue created a task force to find solutions to this problem. And then Pat McCrory, while running for governor of North Carolina, used this misclassification and loss of tax revenue, which is what it is, as an example of how state government was broken. That was a mantra that he repeated many times over, and he promised that's why he wanted to be elected, to fix state government because it was broken. The head of the task force that Governor Perdue appointed to lead this group asked the new governor for direction when he took office and has yet, I'm told, to hear from Pat McCrory. How do you explain that? I mean, surely you talked to Pat McCrory in the course of this story, didn't you, Mandy?
I was unable to speak with him in the process of reporting this story, though I did speak with him at the very end of our series being published. And the governor says that he believes these issues are important and that he has been directing an executive appointment of his, Andrew Heath, at the State Industrial Commission to come up with some ideas on how to address these issues going forward. So the governor would tell you that he hasn't been ignoring these issues. Clearly, Democrats, clearly the head of the task force, felt very differently by his lack of response over the course of a year and a half, not responding to that executive report that they submitted to him in January 2013.
North Carolina Secretary of Labor, Cherry Berry, or Cherie Berry, I guess that's how you say her name, really, would not talk to you, I understand. Why not?
We had a lot of back and forth over the course of the summer. They asked me to submit written questions, which we just don't do. We believe that our elected officials ought to make themselves available to us to discuss important issues critical to people in this state. And as Commissioner of Labor, this should be a top priority for her. And we believe she should have made herself available. They have persistently told me that I misunderstand their role in addressing this, and so I have invited them again to sit with me and explain to me exactly what their role and what barriers or limitations they may have as the State Department of Labor to address these types of labor violations.
Mandy Locke is staff writer for the Raleigh News and Observer. Rick Rothacker is a business reporter for the Charlotte Observer. We're talking about their series, Contract to Cheat, which you can see at charlotteobserver.com. We're coming right back. Charlotte Talks on WFAE. Support for Charlotte Talks comes from WFAE members and Audi of Charlotte, presenting a selection of luxury vehicles committed to customer service and satisfaction. East Independence Boulevard, inside the 485 Beltway. Audi, truth and engineering. Information at audioftheCharlotte.com. And Diamonds Direct South Park, offering certified diamonds, more than 5,000 engagement ring mountings, pearls, colored gemstones. Sharon Road across from South Park Mall. Diamonds-Direct.com. There has been an explosion of interest in craft beer and microbreweries in the Queen City, and we're going to record a special show about the history and growth of Charlotte's beer scene at Old Mecklenburg Brewery on Thursday night. The show starts at 6:30. I'll be there at 5, and you can be part of the program as well, which you'll hear on Friday on this program. Details at WFAE.org/Charlotte Talks. And coming up on the Diane Rehm Show, scientists reporting greenhouse gas emissions spiked to record levels in 2013. That and more at 10.
All Things Considered offers a thorough and accurate perspective on the day's news. Mark Rumsey, Robert Siegel, Melissa Block, and Audie Cornish guide you through the day's events each weekday evening from 4 to 6:30 on WFAE. Stay connected to what's going on locally, nationally, and around the world by listening each day to All Things Considered on listener-supported 90.7 WFAE.
Charlotte Talks on WFAE and WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. Rick Rothacker and Mandy Locke are with us from The Observer and the Raleigh News and Observer. They participated with, I think, 8 other newspapers around the country in the McClatchy chain on a series called Contract to Cheat, which we are talking about this morning. We've talked about some of these roadblocks, the fact that the governor, you had difficulty talking to the governor in the course of writing this over the course of a year, this series, and the Secretary of Labor wouldn't speak to you either. Is that the normal course of events when you're in, when you're doing an investigative series, that people in government find it easy not to talk to you or don't want to talk to you, find justification for not talking to the media? Rick?
I think sometimes in these series, as you're working on it, maybe it's in their interest to try to hold back and see what's going to actually come out of it. And then once it hits the paper, they realize, okay, people are talking about this and they're seeing the story. We better kind of scramble and respond.
What other roadblocks were put up? I know that you mentioned, one of you mentioned, the lawsuits to get the payroll records.
Yeah, Mandy did a lot of work just getting these documents in the first place, dealing with HUD and the local housing agencies to the point where the Observer and the NNO filed lawsuits, and she can talk more about the details on that.
So these records are housed in these local agencies across the state, and if you read our public records law in the state of North Carolina, anyone would interpret these records as being subject to the North Carolina public records law. And when I filed requests to collect these records directly from housing authorities in cities and counties, HUD essentially advised them that these records are not subject to the North Carolina public records law and that they should not provide them directly to me.
Why not? Why wouldn't they be subject to the law?
Well, according to the email exchanges between HUD and the local agencies, their interpretation was that these were federal records, even though they were not housed in federal agencies, and that their agency ought to be the one reviewing them, redacting them, coming up with charges, coming up with a schedule for release of these records. And we didn't believe that we should have to contact a federal agency 300 miles away when across town these records were sitting in filing cabinets and boxes. So we filed a lawsuit, and slowly, surely, these local agencies started to provide the records to us directly as they should under the law.
Now, you report that your investigation reveals that since 2009, more than a third of workers were treated as independent contractors rather than employees as the law and the regulations require. Why only a third? I mean, if companies are really doing this deliberately, why wouldn't they make half or three quarters or all of their employees contractors as opposed to employees? Mandy?
Well, bear in mind, Mike, that these companies are having to provide their payroll report every single week to government regulators. So if you're a company owner and you have any sense of your obligations under labor laws and the IRS, you would be reluctant, I would imagine, to provide information on these certified payroll records that you have treated workers who ought to be employees as independent contractors. So I believe that that process of filing these forms every single week was some sort of deterrent. Now, why it wasn't more, that's my only best guess. But I do believe that there are a lot of companies out there that strive every day to do things the right way, and many of them participated in these projects. So they would tell you that oftentimes they participated in these projects for little or no profit because of their labor costs alone.
Hmm. You talked about some of the specific guidelines. There's a way you can legally make somebody a contractor, but you have to give them certain leeway, and there are certain definitions of what they can and cannot do that you've got to be willing to go along with. Otherwise, you have to make them employees and file W-2s and pay taxes and Social Security and all the other things that go on. And you report, though, that each year in North Carolina alone, the state and federal government fail to collect $470 million in revenue, $134 million in state income and unemployment taxes. That's real money. Is this happening in other states as well? I mean, and why are states, which are generally strapped for cash, we keep saying in North Carolina that the recession was crippling and that tax revenues are down and we don't know that we can fund education, we don't know if we can fund this or that. Why, as we are emerging from this recession, are they ignoring this missing revenue?
Yeah, I think that's a big irony of the series that here is that's one of the biggest problems of state government is lack of tax revenue, and they're just totally missing this. And I think that's to the credit of the newspapers to try to shine a light in this, that, hey, here's something they should be looking at.
Another problem is that when workers are misclassified and issued 1099s, they have to pay a portion of the taxes normally paid by their employers. And in most cases, they aren't doing that. They are underreporting. That hasn't been caught either?
Well, I think they're missing the underreporting, and it really kind of highlights that this is a big impact on workers. I mean, workers, you know, if anyone's had a 1099 before, suddenly you're paying a lot more tax at the end of the year, and you may also not have workers' comp and other things as well.
And if you're making $7 or $8 or $9 or $10 an hour as a contractor, can you afford to pay your fair share of what employers would pay?
Probably not. And, you know, one of the best stories in the series Mandy did, where she really spent a lot of time with one of the workers, just the real tightrope this guy and his family were walking trying to make a go of life. Mandy can talk more about that.
It was really extraordinary to meet this family. They lived in the Triad region of our state, and this worker logged 60, 70 hours a week driving to jobs all across the state. He was paid $10 an hour, yet because he was an independent contractor, he was expected to drive his own truck, put fuel in his truck, get his own hard hat, get his own tool belt, pay for his meals on the road, pay for his lodging if they were traveling out of town. And if you can do math, a quick calculation will tell you that that is absolutely no way to make a living on $10 an hour. So pretty quickly, this family found themselves in a situation where they were having to turn to the county social services office to apply for food stamps to help support their family.
So by turning a blind eye to this, the state is actually creating a welfare state.
It's certainly... And Mandy had a great point in one of her stories. Some of the workers who were building these fairly nice apartment buildings probably couldn't afford to live in them. And that was maybe the biggest irony of the series.
Let me read a couple of emails and tweets that have come in while we've been talking. Anthony says, y'all are missing the biggest expense, workman's comp. Also ask about the sketchy ghost insurance policies that individuals are forced to buy to protect the employer. Do you know anything about that?
Absolutely. Anthony is right on point. Huge cost that companies treating their workers as independent contractors avoid is workers' comp. If you run a roofing crew, that is a significant cost, maybe 10, 15, even 20%.
Well, Kent in Spruce Pine says it is 20%, and it's the biggest cost.
Yep, absolutely it is. Now, in North Carolina, we have this policy called a ghost policy. It's the cheapest policy you can buy, and essentially to get it, you are asserting that you run your own business, you have no employees. But this policy looks exactly like another policy that a company might have paid $10,000, $15,000 for. And this kind of policy is perpetually being used in the construction industry for companies to sort of assert that they have workers' comp when in fact it's kind of this empty, meaningless policy.
Debbie emails, another concern that I have not heard mentioned is the possibility of the independent contractors, in quotes, who do not get 1099s, maybe also applying for and receiving various government benefits. If the contractor's declared income is below a certain amount for the appearance, is or the appearance is that the contractor is out of work, that person may very well qualify for assistance with food, possibly unemployment benefits, and so on. So in addition to the actual lack of federal and state income tax being paid or collected, the taxpayers may very well be on the hook for assistance benefits. We've already talked a little bit about this. I'm all for less government, but in all of our lives, but we should all pay our fair share, and the contractors who participate in this kind of misclassifying of employees to avoid paying taxes are cheating the so-called honest companies. You talk about that in your series. A lot of honest companies are being who are trying to follow the rules, who in fact are following the rules, are suffering consequences because they can't afford to compete.
Yeah, I think that's, you know, probably one of the big genesis of Mandy's original series was hearing from the good contractors. And for me, after the series ran, I think that was probably the biggest reaction that I got from people was the good contractor saying, hey, this has been going on forever. Thanks for putting some light on this. And it's really made life hard for people who are trying to do the right way.
It costs what these businesses are they the ones that are trying to follow the law, are they winning any of these contracts, or are they just losing money by taking these contracts because they're doing the right thing and they have to underbid their own costs? Mandy.
Often these companies are actually losing money by participating in these projects. I talked to some company owners who bid on these government jobs. They lowered their bids significantly, knowing that they were having to compete against companies that were cheating. And they were simply trying to get these jobs during the recession to make payroll.
So this doesn't sound very – this is a business-friendly state. We've established that. And one of the reasons – we assume one of the reasons that this is being allowed to happen is that it's business-friendly. But it's not business friendly if businesses who are trying to follow the rules are being penalized. So why aren't they up in arms? Why aren't they at the legislature in Raleigh? Why aren't they talking to the IRS about the companies that they know are not following the rules and are undercutting them and costing them money? Why aren't they complaining?
I think some are. We actually, Mandy had talked to some who had reported some of these companies, said, hey, you should look at them. And I talked to the plumbing board, and they said they tried to look. They can't really audit people's books. It's hard to for them to actually figure it out.
And I think you did it.
Yeah, they're happy to see these that we dug up these payroll records. And I think Mandy could probably talk more about some of the contractor efforts to fight this.
That's right. I think that in some ways our series forced industry leaders to reckon with the significance of this problem. And I've heard from many general contractors and some affordable housing agencies that say they are going to take the initiative on their own to educate contractors, subcontractors about their responsibilities and come up with some sort of strategy for reporting companies that are violating these laws.
I mean, what should we take from this? That businesses who are following the rules are being penalized either by having to undercut their own costs or walking away from the bidding process because they can't afford to compete with the companies who are cheating. And workers are being penalized to the point where they are not getting the benefits that the law says they should get and are having to turn to the social system to get food because they can't afford to live on what they're being paid and all the costs that they have to incur personally. While businesses that are cheating are walking away scot-free, what are we to take from all of this? What does that say about process and government?
Well, I think it says, Mike, that sometimes it doesn't make a lot of sense, that the obvious problems are sometimes the hardest to fix. And I think it should also say that it's time. We need to address this.
At the depths of the recession, as you said, many of these federally funded projects were, stimulus projects to get the economy rolling, to get people back to work, to put boots on the ground and shovel-ready projects were funded. That's what a lot of this was. And the government was funneling millions, hundreds of millions of dollars into this. They expected something back. They expected that these workers who were then working would be paying taxes, and some of that stimulus money would come back into the Treasury. It didn't happen.
No, I mean, one of the stories in the series, we looked at the North Carolina agency that kind of funneled a lot of this money out to the projects. And, you know, Mandy sat down with them, and they just said, we were just not looking for this at all. And, you know, they actually now say that they're going to try to do a better job at it. But it's kind of the barn door's open.
Let's talk about that, because right after this series ran, there was a report that Congress would be looking into this, and then they went on recess. So what, if anything, has come of that promise at the congressional level? Mandy?
I think that we're just sort of waiting. We're hoping, waiting, that when they come back to session, that this is going to be a top priority. And we'll keep after them. We'll keep asking. We'll keep shining light. And we'll keep readers informed.
What have you heard from state officials?
I've heard a lot of promises and commitment to move forward with addressing this issue both legislatively and through regulations that are already on the books. So we'll see. Again, we'll keep watching. We'll let our readers know how this is progressing, and we'll keep asking those hard questions.
You named names in this series, names of companies that are cheating, that are going against these rules and regulations. Has anything happened to those companies, or have they responded to you in any way in the week since this story has run?
A couple of the companies, the plumbing board, because one of the issues we raised was some of the specialty firms like plumbing, there's actually some rules that your workers have to be employees, because they want these employees controlled to make sure they're doing it the right way. And the plumbing board has told me that they're looking at one of the companies up in Salisbury. There was a company that Mandy wrote about that essentially after Mandy started asking questions, they almost kind of self-reported themselves to the board, and they're going to have a conference, I think, next month to try to work through that. So I think some of the companies are getting some scrutiny out of this.
When a newspaper embarks on a story like this, we've already talked about this, you don't know that it's going to pay dividends. You don't even know that the story will ever make the paper, because you don't know what the end result is. There may have been no story there, but there was in this case. So you're putting yourself at risk. Has it paid any tangible dividends to any of the newspapers involved in this story?
I'd say just in goodwill, people appreciate this kind of stories and are glad the newspapers are out there doing this.
The series is called Contract to Cheat. You can read it on charlotteobserver.com. Rick Rothacker is a business reporter there at The Observer, and Mandy Locke is a staff writer for the Raleigh News and Observer. Both contributed heavily to this series. Thank you both for the hour.
Thanks.
Charlotte talks with